Welcome back to the Recovering Investment Banker podcast. I'm your host, Eric Knight, and with me, as always, is the Recovering Investment Banker, Chris Kaufman. Chris, welcome.
Thank you, Eric. By the way, great shot a couple weeks ago.
Oh, yes, thank you. We went on a hunting trip, and it was awesome. I'm very, very pleased to have gotten an elk. And after 10 hours of packing that elk out of the mountains.
Vertically.
Yeah, vertically. Once I get the meat, I'm sure it'll be worth it. At least I hope so.
Oh, definitely will. Elk is amazing.
Well, this is episode 7. And the reason we haven't done an episode in the last few weeks is because of that trip and others, and we've been traveling. But today's topic is one that is very, very important. And I think a lot of people who are otherwise not connected to the financial system are hearing this buzzword a lot, and that word is inflation. So today we're going to talk about what is inflation and how does it impact us as individuals, and how does it impact the broader economy and the capital markets. So Chris, I'll start with you. In just like a sentence or two, quickly define inflation and then let's expand on it. What is inflation?
Inflation is the sickness of money. It's a monetary phenomenon. The best way to define it is money becomes worth less every second, every hour, every day, every month, every year. So when you have inflation, the value of your money is disappearing. That's inflation, period.
So why is it called inflation? Wouldn't that be deflation?
Yeah, good question. The reason it's called inflation is because the size of the money supply is growing. Basically, again, there's all kinds of academic debate, but we can just cut right through this crap. There's more money chasing the same number of goods and services. So it's inflating. There's more money. And of course, if nothing else changes, more of something becomes less and less valuable. And that's inflation.
And in the current situation, because of COVID and, well, mainly the policies that have been in reaction to COVID, there are actually less goods and services available in many sectors of the economy because of the labor shortage, the supply chain shortages, and there's a ton of money being pumped into the system. So that's why we're seeing such rapid inflation now. Is that correct?
Yeah. And having analyzed the problem, Eric, let's just finish the podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Just kidding. No, but you've actually nailed it. That's how everyone can go have a cup of coffee or have an early beer or whatever. Nice. We're done.
Sweet. But, well, I'm really glad we had this episode. This is the shortest episode we've ever had. Okay, let's expand on that. So inflation is the increasing volume of money chasing the same or less goods and services. So the value of money decreases. Where did this term come from? What's the history?
Well, so let's actually, you really set it up well. So I'm just going to jump in and give you an example because COVID really is a massive factor here. The money supply in the United States in early 2020 was about $5 trillion. And I won't go into all the, you know, ways to define money supply, but basically, you know, not that long ago, there was $5 trillion that was powering our economy, providing liquidity, providing people enough money to move around the banking system, investments and saving. It was $5 trillion. And the economy back in 2020 was about $21 trillion. So, you know, roughly $21 trillion of economic activity was being, you know, kept liquid and kind of oiled, if you will.
And that's just in the United States.
Correct.
Okay.
We're only going to talk about U.S. dollars today.
Okay.
Because there are some other problems in other countries, but basically the U.S. is in pretty big trouble, actually. So it's going to be kind of the bellwether. So today, in August 2021, or actually a month or two ago, most recent figures, the money supply in the United States was just under $20 trillion.
From five.
About 18 months
ago. So it has quadrupled.
Correct.
How on earth did that happen?
Basically, they shut the economy down, and then they flooded it with money to keep people alive, basically, because they couldn't earn money and they couldn't run their businesses. So that's what happened.
But to the point, I mean, I remember $2 trillion here, $3 trillion there. I don't remember $15
trillion. Yeah, well... We're not talking about just borrowing. We're talking about the expansion of the money supply.
So printing.
Yeah, that gets into some very complicated mechanisms and so forth, which I won't go into because it's going to make everyone's eyes roll up in the back of their heads. But and it's really not even the point. Let's take, for example, the funding of World War I. So in World War I, you know, we had obviously we're fighting the Germans and blah, blah, blah. We had to gear up and all sorts of stuff. And people went from their civilian jobs into the army, you know, kind of a COVID type crisis, if you will. So what's interesting about that is how was World War I funded? Now, you're kind of a traditional guy with a hard head and some good background. You probably go, oh, well, there was two ways it was funded. It was funded by taxation. It was funded by borrowing. And that would be a very sensible response. But you will recall probably that the Federal Reserve had just been started a few years before World War I started. And that gave policymakers another option. Now, that option is, in fact, probably the forefront of what happened with COVID. But even back in World War I, when things were still pretty simple, only 21% of World War I spending in the United States was funded by taxation.
Huh.
56%, again, this is traditional stuff, was funded by borrowing, U.S. government borrowing, you know, war bonds. And
right. I remember seeing the marketing for war bonds when I was in school, looking at buy war bonds, support the
exactly.
effort. Right.
Exactly. So they were borrowing from the American people through those war bonds, kind of small amounts of money. And then, you know, also in the markets, the financial markets, they were issuing treasury securities. But that was only slightly less than 80% of the funding. 23% of the funding of World War I, even the old days, even old school, was through money creation.
Printing.
Correct. So they funded 23% of World War I through printing money. Today, printing money is almost the main way. I mean, we're borrowing an enormous amount of money, of course, as well. But no one's watching. Well, people are watching it. No one's talking about it. What's going on is massive money creation. Massive. And what that tells us is we're going to end up with inflation. In fact, it's already happening. I could see inflation happening about, you know, over 12 months ago. It was clear. Everyone was denying it. The government was denying it. Treasury was denying it. Federal Reserve was denying it.
Yeah, but your grocery receipt doesn't lie.
It doesn't. And of course, there's all kinds of sophisticated explanations for things, which is why we're not going to go into any of that theory because so much of the time is just to cover. Let me just make a point here. I have friends who have, you know, considerable financial assets, i.e. wealth, and they spend a lot of money on their advisors and their funds managers. And guess what their funds managers were telling them, and may still be telling them, although I think it's pretty hard to maintain the lie. What they were telling them was, oh, this is all very temporary. This is just, the real concern is deflation. This is only going to go up for a few months and then it's going to go. Now, why would a funds manager, why would a financial advisor be telling their clients that not to worry about inflation?
Well, they probably don't want them to take their money out of the fund.
Correct, which is denominated in dollars. Exactly. So the financial world has no interest in providing early warning. As far as I'm concerned, 12 or 14 months ago, it was already pretty obvious what was starting to happen. Prices were already starting to rise.
Oh, they're huge in every industry outside of your own pocketbook. Just, you know, in my business, the cost of raw materials has gone up 23%.
Denominated in dollars.
Yes.
Right. That's 23% inflation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's insane. And yeah. We can't pass that along entirely to the customer all at once, but we also can't eat it. So you got to work your way up through price increases that we don't want to do, but we have to.
Yeah, well, the point is that money is no longer stable in the United States economy. It can no longer be counted on that a dollar is a dollar. And by the way, it hasn't been since fiat currency. The Federal Reserve, ever since the Federal Reserve was established, there's been a steady decline in the value of the U.S. dollar.
So you say fiat currency. What does that mean?
Yeah, fiat means simply I can create currency because I can. It's, you know, I'm
so
the U.S. government.
So it's not.
It's not backed
not
by
real.
Anything. Correct. Well, yeah, it's real as long as people act like it's real. As long as I want to sell you a can of Coke, which these days, what does it cost? I don't know, $2, $3. It cost 25 cents when I was a kid. And you accept the dollar, then it's real. But if you stop accepting it, it's no longer real. That's fiat currency.
Interesting.
Yeah. So we are basically, we have an enormous money supply in comparison to what we had 18 months ago. Let's look at, and we think about financial markets and ultimately what we ourselves can do personally to manage this inflation risk. Let's look at a very, very smart, very dominant economic actor. Let's look at China. China, in the last year, their exports to the United States went up like 25 or 26%, which is incredible. And that has all kinds of implications I won't necessarily talk about. But I think roughly they sold roughly $300 billion in goods denominated in U.S. dollars to the United States. And of course, they've been doing that for a very long time. So not surprisingly, China has the largest foreign exchange reserves in the world outside the United States. They're the largest holder of U.S. dollars of any other country outside the U.S. Right now, for example, they hold $1 trillion in U.S. government debt, which is 14% of all U.S. government debt held by non-Americans.
Wow.
They have $3.4 trillion in total reserves. But what's interesting is in 2005, and basically the money supply of the United States started to really go down the toilet in 2008, 2009 in response to the global financial crisis. That was when monetary policy started loosening. Back then, I think money supply was around $2.5 trillion. It doubled roughly between 2008 and 2020. As a response to the crisis and so forth. And then it quadrupled from early 2020 until now. But let's look at what the Chinese were doing. In 2005, they held 80% of their foreign currency reserves in U.S. dollars. In 2019, which is the last data that I could find, they held 58% of their foreign currency reserves in U.S. dollars. And you might say, oh, well, that's actually quite a lot.
So it started, wait, what was the first number?
In 2005, it was about 80%.
80%. So they went down to
58%.
So
that's 2019.
Okay.
For all I know, they've gone down a lot farther than that. So China, even though their exports to the United States, which means their earnings in U.S. dollars are booming, are steadily banging down the amount of U.S. dollars they hold in favor of other currencies. They are signaling that they want to get out as much as possible of the U.S. dollar. So, for example, the average of countries around the world, the percentage of U.S. dollars they hold in their foreign currency reserves, 65%. It's about two-thirds. China is at 58% and heading down, probably around 50% now. So China is holding less U.S. dollars than average of the other countries. So what that's telling you is that is a massive vote of no confidence in the U.S. dollar by very, very smart actors who, by the way, are stuck with a fire hose of new dollars every year because of their exports. So they've got a big problem from their perspective. They keep earning U.S. dollars and they don't want U.S. dollars.
So they're converting it or they're trading it with other currencies.
Right. Correct. They're buying euros. They're buying God knows what else. Yeah. So we Americans, who of course are swimming in an ocean of dollars, we're kind of in a bit of a jam, actually, because we have less choice than the Chinese do.
So, as an individual like myself, inflation is coming. The devaluation of the dollar continues.
Yeah, inflation has arrived.
Yeah, well, it has. Well, but like, you know, real inflation, as the experts would say, it hasn't arrived yet. Yeah, right. Okay, we're seeing it. But the point is, what can an individual like me do about it?
Well, there's a few classic strategies. The basic thing to remember is that inflation is a monetary phenomenon. Inflation relates to money. So, you know, if you own your house, and I know you just sold your house, but if you own your house, if there's rampant inflation, the dollar value of your house might double in, say, 3 to 5 years, or if it's not, inflation's not that bad, let's say 8 or 10 years, it's still the same house.
Right.
And so same thing with, you know, basically it's a little bit sophisticated because the question is, can you borrow for less than inflation? So for example, right now what we're looking at is very low interest rates, you know, 2% or something like that. And inflation, which is, I think, officially measured at 5 or 6% year on year, and probably is much higher than that. It's probably 10, 15%, maybe even 20% as you're seeing. So what a good strategy would be to borrow at 2% to buy things, knowing that you're going to be able to pay it back with your salary going up because ultimately your employer is going to have to keep up with inflation, and pay back the money you borrowed today at 2% in cheaper dollars in 3 to 5 years when your salary has gone up every year by 10% or whatever it's going to be required to keep your employer from keeping you working for them. You know, as recent, I think about a month or two ago, Goldman Sachs gave like all of their junior level employees like across the board 20% pay raise across the board. Now, I don't know, because I'm not getting Goldman Sachs information, I don't know if Goldman Sachs is saying, oh, we've got inflation to their clients. Maybe they are. But the fact that they put across the board a pay raise through their own employees tells you that they think inflation is 20%.
Huh.
So if you can borrow at 2%, knowing you're looking at several years ahead of 10% or 20% pay increases, that's a smart strategy. Because you're going to be paying back with less valuable dollars.
Doesn't that inspire a pretty perverse incentive to take out debt? I mean, it seems to me like the people that don't have debt, that have managed their money well, that are responsible with the money they earn, are actually going to get penalized when it comes to inflation if they're not leveraged with debt.
Well, Eric, you come to a very sensitive point. And the point is that the reason why governments allow inflation in their money supply is because it's a way of silently stealing from people. So if you think about the advice I just gave, that tells you why the U.S. government is doing this. Because what is the national debt? You probably know better than I do these days.
In the mid-20s, trillions of dollars. And by the way, for the audience, here's something that I heard about a trillion. Because it just sounds like billion. It sounds like million. A trillion is 1,000 billion. And a billion is 1,000 million. Which means a trillion is 10,000 million. If you think a million is a lot, multiply that by 10,000. You got 10,000 of those. Now, if you were to do this in seconds, all right, every dollar is worth 1 second to get to 1 trillion seconds. Chris, just take a stab at it. You probably already heard this, but how long, I'll give you a hint, in years, is 1 trillion seconds?
Okay, well, it would probably take me about 45 seconds to work it out. I'm not going to do that
just take a stab at it.
Silent on a podcast. Let me see. I'll say 105 years.
Okay. It's over 32,000 years.
Oh, 30. So off by, wow. Where's
by that much. But that's the point, right? If you were thinking a billion, maybe, but this is what we lose sight of. It's just more zeros, right? 32,000 years to count to 1 trillion. And we are like 25 or 26 of those in debt at the time of recording this, or at least the last time I checked. It's probably higher now. That's insane. And that's just us. There's other countries in massive debt too.
Oh yeah. Well, they all kind of went down the same rabbit hole of putting their economies into cardiac arrest and then borrowing and inflating their money supply. So yeah, it's a global phenomenon. But the point of that is, though, Eric, when I'm suggesting if you can borrow for 2% and you know you're going to get, or you have good reason to believe you're going to get pay raises because your employer is going to have to pay everybody more and, of course, charge customers more, blah, 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 then that's a good strategy. That tells you why it happened, because the U.S. government borrowed so much money they can't possibly pay it back in the money values of 2019 or 2010 or whatever. So they're destroying the currency so that when it gets paid back, it'll be paid back in cheaper dollars.
Oh.
That's, you know, and then you get to, now I think hopefully, although I don't like the look of these numbers, but what I'm hoping is that we're going to go back at worst to the 70s, where you had like, you know, 10%, 12%, 15%, 18% inflation year on year. But I don't know that that's going to happen. You know, the worst case scenario is we're talking trillions. You know, it took billions to buy a loaf of bread in Germany in 1924. You know, Brazil destroyed their currency. Argentina destroyed its currency. People don't realize that you don't have to go back hundreds of years to come up with examples of what we just done to ourselves. It's actually almost living memory in the case of Germany, and it's certainly living memory in the case of places like Argentina and Brazil.
Well, what about Venezuela today?
Yeah, right. Another example. Classic. Yeah, exactly the same thing, and that's what we're doing.
Well, so the U.S. dollar is sort of considered the international standard currency for now, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
It has been for a long time, but apparently, if I'm understanding what you're saying, that's not guaranteed.
Well, the Chinese is certainly not guaranteed because everyone has to agree to it. The thing about money is involved in every transaction. So it's one half of every transaction that happens in the global economy. So it's actually incredibly important, but its role is not to be exciting. Its role is to be completely neutral.
And consistent.
And consistent. It should be the same value this year as it was last year and 5 years ago and 10 years ago. And we know it's going to be the same value in 5 years or 10 years. And of course, that's the opposite of what's happening. So, when people come to a view, which takes a long time, but the new consensus emerges about something as central and important as money, or a particular currency, in this case, the U.S. dollar, it's going to change. Several years ago, the Chinese were making rumblings about trying to put up their hand to use their currency as a reserve currency. And everyone just kind of said, so what? Who cares? But as we can see, they started to make moves. They started to move from 80% plus of U.S. dollar reserves down to maybe around half. So they are on the march, and they are making adjustments from their privileged position as one of the largest economic powers in the world, and the largest investor in U.S. Securities in the world.
So if I'm understanding this correct, because it's the supply of money relative to the amount of goods and services, this is really a government-caused problem.
Oh, it's a 100% government caused problem.
Not economic. This is not the private sector causing inflation. This is government printing more money than they should.
Correct.
Interesting. It is fascinating to me, and also infuriating, just how much power the people that are coming up with this monetary policy actually have, and how mismanaged it has been for so long. It's just astounding. I mean, if you listen to economists from a long time ago, I remember watching YouTube videos just explaining supply and demand. Simple, and I'm not an economics major at all. I really never even taken an economics course, but listening to guys like Milton Friedman on explaining what money is actually worth, what it actually does, gosh, I feel like those lessons are so lost. Now, when you were learning about this, who were you listening to?
So Milton Friedman is a classic. In fact, Eric, I'm just going to put in a plug for Three Dead Guys. Milton Friedman is the guy on monetary policy. He showed that the reason for the depression of the 1930s was the money supply shrank by about 30%. Another great guy is a guy named Ronald Coase, who is a Nobel Prize winning economist who came up with the theory of the firm. I'd love to talk about that sometime because it's so important now. Our economy is being dominated by the big box stores and global corporations and Facebook and so on. Coase kind of explains that, and he also talks about what's interesting is that even though companies exist and operate in a market, within a company, there's no market. So for example, you know, you're the sales guy at your company. You've got a chief financial officer, you've got, you know, head of operations, you've got, you know, engineering, technical people and so forth. If you were operating in a market, they would be bidding out that sales role every day, every week, every month. They'd be bidding out the engineering function, the operations function. They'd be bidding for CFOs, but they don't do that. So there is no market happening inside your company. And so that's fine for a small company, entrepreneurial, you know, servicing its customers and doing what it should be doing. But when you get to a certain size, like Walmart or Costco or Facebook, the fact that they have kind of digested the market and they have created a non-market environment is a real problem, because people talk about what's wrong with America is, oh, we have capitalism and we have markets and it's also heartless, and that's nonsense. 20% of our economy is healthcare, and there is no market whatsoever in healthcare. Another huge sections of our economy have been absorbed by enormous corporations, and those corporations have extinguished the market within their realm. And that's what they actually want to do, because then they can control prices and they control costs. Anyway, so that's Ronald Coase. The third guy is Ludwig Erhard, who was the architect of the German miracle. 1945, the place is bombed out. Everyone's hungry and starving and cold. You know, within a generation, it was the second or third largest economic power in the world again. And that was all because of Ludwig Erhard. And we can talk about him sometime too, but basically, his prescriptions, which turned Germany back into a powerhouse, are the opposite of what's happening in the U.S. economy and the U.S. government policies.
So give me an example of that. What was one of the things that he implemented?
Okay, well, he basically, and actually, you know, it didn't, it's not very hard. He had two basic principles. Basic principle number one was no special deals for any corporation, no special regulations, no special subsidies. They have to compete. And that in itself, against powerful opposition by the still very influential German corporate sector, made all the difference in the world. So
no, you know, crony capitalism, basically.
No crony capitalism. And crony capitalism has taken over the United States. Ludwig Erhard said none of that. Everyone has to compete. There's no barriers to entry. Everyone gets to do whatever they want to do economically. And that is what actually did it. The second thing he did was, he actually, taxes on the average person in 1946-47 in Germany were 85%. The highest tax rate was 95%. And he reduced taxes from 85% to 18%. And of course, that's the opposite of what's going on here. So no one wants to talk about Ludwig Erhard, even though he did the single most astounding economic accomplishment in the last 100 years, which was take bombed out, starving, freezing Germany and turning into an economic powerhouse. It's just, we could use his playbook and transform the American economy. But that would cut across all the people who run the place now, and they don't want it to happen.
That's astounding, because it's been a problem for a long time. Well, anyway, let's wrap this up. This has been episode 7 of The Recovering Investment Banker. Chris, thank you so much for your insight. I actually learned a lot. I'd heard of inflation. I knew kind of the basics. But when you reached out and said, hey, let's talk about inflation, I thought that's a really timely topic, because we hear about it all the time. And who knows what we're going to talk about next time, but we're going to try to continue on this path of logic. So Chris Kaufman, author of Crisis Deluxe. If you haven't read the book, I believe that book, The Problem, The Actual Crisis Itself, has quite a bit to do with valuation of currencies. So enjoy
yeah,
that
it did
read.
Actually.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. It caused a massive crisis. So, Chris, again, thank you.
Thank you, Eric.
Until next time, we'll see you later.